Welcome to Torati Mecha Nach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Rachel Kosowski, and today we will be studying Megillat Esther Perek Bet, Chapter 2. Yesterday, we learned Megillat Esther Perek Aleph, Chapter 1, which introduced us to the King Ahasuerus and the Persian court, which involves a way of life filled with egoism and self-indulgence, completely contrary to the Avodat Hashem, service of God, expected by the Torah. So far, on the face of it, this book has nothing to do with the Jewish people. The role of Jews in this story begins in today's Perek, Chapter 2. By the end of Chapter 1, Ahasuerus, in a drunken state, had followed Memuchan's advice and either had Vashti killed or banished. Chapter 2 opens with the effects of the alcohol having worn off and Ahasuerus seemingly regretting having gotten rid of Vashti. The text then tells us that he gets advice from Na'arei HaMelech, literally the youths of the king. The Dot Mikra commentary suggests that this designation indicates their lower stature in the king's court. Perhaps it could also indicate their age, given the suggestion they give Ahasuerus. They recommend that the king appoint officers throughout his 127 provinces to gather all the young, beautiful virgins in the kingdom to Shushan, the capital city, so Ahasuerus can choose Vashti's successor. When I was a child learning the story of Megillat Esther, I envisioned a beauty pageant in which all the beautiful women lined up before Ahasuerus and he chose his favorite. A close reading of the text reveals a very different story. Initially, the women are taken to Beit HaNashim, the house for women, run by Hega or Hegai, Shomer HaNashim, literally the keeper of the women. Later on in Pasuk Yedaled, verse 14, the text tells us that each woman was taken to the king in the evening, and the following morning she was returned to a second house for women run by Shashgaz, Shomer HaPilak Shim, the keeper of the concubines. So, each woman spent the night with the king and went from being a virgin to a concubine the next morning, with the obvious implication of what happened each night, and the clear indication that Ahasuerus kept all these women he gathered as part of his harem for him to summon as he pleased. Once again, we are brought into a world in which kings can do whatever they want with no regard for others. Perhaps some women viewed this as a great opportunity. Others may have been horrified at this prospect. Their opinion is of no consequence to Ahasuerus. Once again, we can notice the contrast to what the Torah expects from the kings of Israel. Back in Sefer Dvarim, Perek Yud Zayin, chapter 17, Moshe Rabbeinu, our teacher Moshe, taught the people of Israel that there are limitations the Torah places on our kings. One of them, in Pasuk Yud Zayin, verse 17, is Lo Yarbelo Nashim. He should not have too many wives. As was mentioned yesterday, the Torah views everyone, including the king, as subject to the authority of the one true king, Hashem. Needless to say, Ahasuerus does not view himself as subject to any limitations. He likes the idea proposed by his attendants and follows the advice. It is at this point in the Megillah that we are introduced to Mordechai in a dramatic pasuk, a verse the congregation recites aloud together when the Megillah is read publicly. This pasuk indicates, Ish Yehudi haya b'shushan habira, ushimo Mordechai ben Ya'ir ben Shimi ben Kish ish Yemini. There was a Jewish man in the capital city of Shushan, and his name was Mordechai, the son of Ya'ir, the son of Shimi, the son of Kish, from the tribe of Binyamin. The Megillah goes on to describe Mordechai as having been exiled from Jerusalem at the time of the Judean king Yuchaniah by the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. This mention of Jerusalem is the only direct reference to the land of Israel in Megillat Esther. Rabbi Menachem Liebtag, in a shiur on his website, tanakh.org, points out that this pasuk is satirical to a reader familiar with Tanakh. Both the phrases Ish Yehudi and Shushan Habira stand out. This is one of only two places in Tanakh in which the phrase Ish Yehudi appears. The other is in a nevuah, a prophecy of Zechariah, in Perek Chet Pasuk Chaf Gimel of Sefer Zechariah, chapter 8, verse 23. In it, Zechariah anticipates a full geula, complete redemption, in which members of all other nations, after witnessing Hashem's miracles, will turn to an Ish Yehudi, a Jewish man, to seek out God. The word habira, which is continually used in reference to Shushan in this Megillah, is used to describe the Beit HaMikdash, our holy temple, in Divrei HaYamim Aleph, Perek Kaftet, chapter 29. Furthermore, the name Mordechai is not only not a Hebrew name, it is a variation on the name Marduk, one of the Babylonian gods. Yesterday we discussed how startling and jarring the description of the Persian court is in the context of the worldview of Tanakh, as well as the comedic element of the Megillah making fun of the superficial and empty pageantry on display. Rabbi Liebtag suggests that to refer to a Jew with the name of a Babylonian god as Ish Yehudi, as found in Zechariah, and the unholy city of Shushan as Habira, is similarly jarring and includes an element of mockery. In this case, however, the mockery seems not to be directed at the Persians, but rather at the Jews who have made themselves comfortable in Galut, in exile, in this unholy environment. We know from the beginning of the book of Ezra, as well as the very end of Divrei Hayamim, that when the Jews came under Persian rule, King Koresh gave them permission to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. The process of building the second temple was long and complicated, but nonetheless, the Jews living in Shushan at the time of Megillat Esther had chosen not to make Aliyah. They had chosen to remain in Shushan when the opportunity to return to Israel had been offered. The wording of our introduction to Mordechai highlights the foolhardiness of this choice from the perspective of the author of the Megillah. According to Ibn Ezra, Mordechai himself had made Aliyah with Zerubbabel. And indeed, in Sefer Ezra, chapter 2, the name Mordechai is in the list of names of those who returned to Israel at that time. Ibn Ezra suggests that Mordechai only returned to join Ahasuerus's court upon seeing that the Beit HaMikdash, our holy temple, had not been rebuilt. After we meet Mordechai, we meet his cousin Hadassah, also known as Esther, who was orphaned as a child. Pasuk Zion, verse 7, tells us that after she was orphaned, Lakha Mordechai lo lebat. Mordechai took her as a daughter. Rashi on this verse cites the rabbinic opinion that Mordechai and Esther were married based on a play of words from bat to bayit, which means house or household, referring to one's wife. Ibn Ezra insists that Esther must have been a virgin because otherwise Mordechai would never have allowed her to be taken. But perhaps Mordechai had been planning to marry Esther. The Megillah tells us that Esther was very beautiful and was taken to the palace. The verb vatilakach, she was taken, which is used when she is initially taken to the palace and later on the evening she is brought to the king, makes it clear that Esther is taken against her will. Esther is described as someone who is noseit chen beinei kol ro'eha, literally carrying grace in the eyes of all who see her. She had a special quality which endeared her to all whom she encountered. This plays out with Haggai in charge of the king's initial house for the women, who gives her preferential treatment. Mordechai instructs Esther not to reveal her identity as a Jew, and she obeys, and Mordechai checks on her welfare daily. The Megillah describes the year-long process each woman went through to prepare for her night with the king, and that these women could ask for anything to bring with them that night. When it's Esther's turn, she does not ask for anything other than that which Haggai tells her to bring, highlighting her disinterest in being a part of this process and contrasting Esther's behavior to the excesses of the Persian court, which we have seen. As is the case with others, Ahasuerus is taken with Esther and crowns her as the new queen to replace Vashti. There is a discussion in the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Ayin Dalid, page 74, regarding situations in which the Torah requires us to sacrifice our lives rather than disobey the Torah. In this context, Esther allowing herself to be violated by Ahasuerus is questioned. One of the answers given by Abaye is that she was completely passive in this encounter. For years, this opinion of Abaye seemed unlikely to me. I wondered why Esther would have been chosen by Ahasuerus if Abaye is correct. One year when I was teaching the Megillah, one of my colleagues suggested that perhaps this is exactly what Ahasuerus was looking for. After eliminating Vashti as a threat to his power, he was looking for someone passive who would not challenge his authority. After Esther's coronation, we have the fourth party of the book, this one in honor of Esther. And we are told that Mordechai is Yoshev Bishar HaMelech, a member of the king's court. Esther continues not to reveal her family and national identity and follow all of Mordechai's instructions as she did when she was raised by him, clearly indicating her high moral character in remaining unaffected by her new political standing. The Perek, chapter 2, ends with an assassination plot against Ahasuerus by two of his guards, Bigtan and Teresh. Mordechai becomes aware of the plot, reports it to Esther, who relays it to the king in Mordechai's name. When the accusation is investigated, it is found to be true. Bigtan and Teresh are hanged, and the episode is recorded in the king's chronicles. The Megillah tells us all about the circumstances which led to Esther becoming the queen of Persia, as well as Mordechai foiling the assassination plot against Ahasuerus, without mentioning any role of Hashem in these events. We, the readers of the story, year after year, recognize the providential nature of how events have unfolded. In Masechet Megillah, on Yud Gimel Amud Bet, page 13b, Reish Lakish states, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu makeh et Yisrael, Ella imkein borei lahem refuah tchila. Hashem does not strike Israel without an antidote in place beforehand. Rava explains that before we meet Haman, who shows up at the beginning of tomorrow's chapter, and learn of his plot to destroy all Jews, the elements are already in place to ensure the Jews' salvation. Esther having become queen and Mordechai being on record as having saved the king's life will be critical to the overturning of Haman's decree, as we will learn. Chapter 2 continues the description of the foolish pursuits of Ahasuerus devoting his efforts to collecting women. It introduces us to the heroes of our story, Mordechai and Esther, who stand in stark contrast to the debauchery of the Persian court, and includes a veiled rebuke of the Jews of Shushan who have chosen to remain there as opposed to having made Aliyah. We have noticed the hidden Yad Hashem, hand of God, in how events are unfolding, and are poised to see the fate of the Jews as the story continues. Thank you for studying together in the memory of our beloved father and grandfather, Ted Ordin, Mordechai ben Ephraim v'Miriam Golda, in commemoration of his 10th Yortzeit. His family is forever grateful for his devotion to family, vision, courage, and optimism. May the merit of our collective learning elevate his neshama and bring unity and peace to Klal Yisrael. Helen and Moshe Sassever and family.